Blog Talk Radio.
To come before you once again with another powerful, powerful show that we've lined up just for you today. As you've been knowing that if you're following Health, Wealth, and Divine, you know we do shows on spirituality, we do shows on health, we do shows on wealth, and this is one of those shows that it's really not a dinner side conversation that well, in some cultures it's not. A dinner side conversation that people have probably should be, but unfortunately it's not. And we're going to be discussing something that a lot of people actually really, really need to discuss. If you don't know firsthand how important this discussion is going to be, then you know somebody who does. We're going to be talking tonight about estate planning. Okay, because this is something that unfortunately is a part of life. You know, as we know, when it comes to living, there's birth and then there's death. And it's what happens after that that oftentimes is the focus of a lot of drama for a lot of people. And we can cut a lot of that out, if not all of it out. So with that in mind, I reached out to a very, very powerful brother who's going to really shed light on this most important topic tonight. My special guest is attorney Gerald W.S. Carter. He's a partner in Harrell and Chambliss and is a graduate of the College of William and Mary and the New York University School of Law. He's got a JD there. And Mr. Carter received his Master's of Law degree in taxation from New York University School of Law, and focuses his practice on business tax, estate planning, tax issues in municipal finance, transactions, real estate, and creditors' rights in bankruptcy. Mr. Carter is a certified public accountant and worked as an accountant before entering law school. Mr. Carter served as an adjunct professor of law at the University of Richmond Law School and is a member of the Virginia State Bar and Hill Tucker Bar Association. And there's a lot more in between. He has served as a member of the Virginia Bar Association Committee on Honoring Members and Judges, and there's so much more. We'd be halfway into the show if I read all of his accomplishments. And so I'm very, very pleased to have as my special guest and introduce to you our brother, attorney Gerald W.S. Carter. Welcome to Health, Wealth, and Divine, my brother. It's great to have you. Thank you for agreeing to be my guest today.
Thank you, Juwanza. I greatly appreciate it, my man. And, look forward to sharing information with our listeners today. And I can tell you one other thing, Juwanza, like you said, there are two things certainly in life that happen, our birth and our death, but also what Uncle Sam says, what other people tell me, you got to pay taxes too. So that's also something we can add to the equation as well. But
okay. But
aside from that, brother, I'm happy to be here and happy to at least share. And I do hope that perhaps if there are listeners this evening, perhaps people might call in with any questions that they have. And
okay.
so One thing I would like to share, well, Juwanza and I had an opportunity, or at least with a few telephone conversations and in person, just to kind of briefly talk about what I'd like to share tonight with everyone. And it involves, like Juwanza said, estate planning. Really the first thing that all of us need to kind of grapple with is that, well, first of all, what is estate planning? What does that mean? And just to kind of break it down in very simple terms, all of us have estates, whether they be large or small. And in essence, what an estate is the assets that we acquire in our lifetime. That's living as well as at our death. Most people say, well, I don't have an estate. But the bottom line is if you have a dollar in your pocket or a dollar in the bank account, or if you have, a car or different sort of things you acquire in life, those are assets. And in essence, assets that you own encompass your estate. And then there are also things that we call intangible assets, and those are things that have value but not necessarily quantifiable value that we personally give to them during our lifetime or during most things that we do in life that do have a value to someone else if they wanted to use that moving forward as a way to create wealth or to earn money from those intangible assets. So I just want to just briefly just discuss with everybody that an estate, first of all, encompasses basically all that you own during your lifetime and at your death. And really what we as planners think about is what happens during different phases in your life. Perhaps during the time that you first get started and you perhaps a person might get married and then you maybe might acquire a home, acquire an automobile, have a few dollars in the account. Then you have children, and, there are other sort of assets that are acquired during that lifetime. Then you plan for their education, and then you plan ultimately for, growing in your field. And then you look forward to retirement. And then after retirement, what are you going to do with those assets? Are you going to give them to charities? Are you going to pass them on to your children or to grandchildren or to friends or different people that have made an impact in your life? Those are the sort of things that planners think about. Those are just the first sort of questions that we ask individuals as to what they would want to accomplish in their lifetime, during the time that they're living and during the time that they move on. But let's talk about an estate. Okay, like I said, an estate basically encompasses all that you own. And in essence, like I shared initially, there are a few different types of assets, or primarily two, that we are aware of for the most part, and that's personal property, and then also there's real property. Personal property, in essence, can be broken down into two components. I mentioned intangible personal property, intangible assets that are personal property, and then also there's what we call tangible personal property or tangible assets. What happens, a tangible personal property asset is basically stuff you can put your hands on. That's like tables, chairs, pictures, electronic equipment, automobiles, just a cadre of things that you can acquire that pretty much so you can utilize, and something that we visualize as being assets that we own. Jewelry, things of that nature, also that is a tangible asset. Rings, watches, all those sort of assets that you purchase are tangible assets. And then there's the other type of asset, an intangible asset. And some of those assets include money, cash, investments, stocks, bonds, options, all the sort of things that really you utilize in order to acquire tangible assets during your lifetime. So that just gives a person just an idea of personal property. So personal property is broken down into intangible personal property and tangible personal property. Then you go to the other asset, the other main asset, and that's real property. And I think all of us understand what that is. For the most part, that's homes, residences that we own, investment property, commercial property, leasehold interests that are worth something, of value, you know, anything that's usually tied to real estate is a real property asset. And primarily the personal property and the real property together really encompass what your estate is. And then in moving forward from that aspect, what happens is then what do you do? How do you amass those assets? And like we said, you usually get a job in life, you acquire assets, and then once you've acquired assets, whether or not they're investment assets, cash, or tangible assets, what's going to happen to those assets during your lifetime and then also when you pass? And what a person usually thinks about, or at least as we as estate planners think about, is perhaps assets that you would want to give to somebody during your lifetime, as well as assets that you want to give to somebody when you die. And so usually what happens when you give an asset to somebody else, that's really what we call a transfer. And in light of that being the case, usually during your lifetime, if you make a transfer of an asset usually that you give to somebody is called a gift. And that is something that is unconditionally given to somebody else without any kind of consideration or compensation paid for that asset. So in essence, let's say hypothetically I want to give my child a car, then usually it is an asset that I've acquired for the benefit of my child. And that is a gift, okay? Mm-hmm. And in concept, it works basically the same way that if I die and I will that car to my child, it's a transfer. The gift is a transfer during your lifetime, in essence, and a bequest or something in my will giving that child that asset is also a transfer, but it is during my death. So the concept of giving gifts during your lifetime are very similar to the concept of giving assets to beneficiaries or other important people in your life after you die. So what you really focus on is that with an estate during your lifetime, if you give an asset to somebody unconditionally, that is a gift. And if you give an asset to somebody when you die, that is usually some sort of bequest or transfer during your death. And so from there, what I'd like to kind of talk about is how do you primarily give assets when you die? A lot of people, for the most part, say, well, what happened? What instrument do you prepare during the time you're living that's going to pass your assets on to somebody else? And the document that we usually prepare is a will. Okay. And in a will, usually what happens is a person basically says, upon my death, I'd like XYZ assets to go to these people. And it can be just as basic as that. A will, you know, we as, estate planning lawyers primarily, plan where there are certain tricks or tools of the trade that you have in a will that accomplishes the best objective for a client in a very cost-effective way. And a will also helps a family through a grieving time, where a person who has died can pretty much spell out how they'd like their assets to pass. Now, when a person dies without a will, they die what we call intestate. And what that means is dying without a will under Virginia law. And then if you go to, and then when a person dies intestate, then you have to look to Virginia law as to how assets will pass upon a person's death.
And does this, when it comes to different states, it's the same thing, just, you know, if a person dies without an estate, let's say they were in D.C., same thing, they would just have to look to D.C. law to determine then what would be the next step?
Absolutely. Juwanza, that's a very good point, because what happens, though, is that, you know, the passing of assets are usually dictated by the jurisdiction or the state, first of all, where you've resided or where you're a citizen. So in the state of Virginia, which is the state primarily which is the state that I practice in, the intestacy laws are pretty I would think they're fair for the most part, but what happens now is that with the phenomena of perhaps blended families and things along those lines, things get a little different than perhaps what a person would normally do if they had known that they should have prepared a will before they would pass. And actually, I mean, I guess that's kind of rhetorical, because a person wouldn't know what the deal is if they're dead, but the problem is how they leave their family. For instance, in Virginia, the intestacy law, the way it's written is that, let's say we have a family of four, husband, wife, and two children, and let's say the husband dies. Then under Virginia law, the assets would automatically pass to the surviving spouse. And that seems very fair and appropriate in most instances. However, though, in Virginia, what also happens is, let's say hypothetically, I, as the husband, also have a blended family. And let's say that I had a child from a prior relationship, and now my children now are, you know, I have a child from a prior relationship, and then I have a child with my wife. It's still the four of us. But under Virginia law, what happens in that particular circumstance is that when I die, if I don't have a will, then one-third of my assets will go to my wife and two-thirds will go to the children. All right. So in some instances, it could create, a level of confusion, or at least, perhaps maybe not the best disposition of the family, because the wife in that particular instance might have, spent a number of years with me for our lives, and might have felt slighted through what might happen if Virginia law controls in this particular circumstance. So
that's why I think just us having this discussion is so important, because if it's all spelled out, you know, prior to, in specific instructions given, with these laws that you just stated taken into consideration, then a lot of that, if not all of that, can be avoided, correct?
Well, I mean, you do the best you can, okay? Some people create wills to create more barriers in their family as well. But the whole idea is that if you do have a will, which I think it's critical for everyone to have, it at least shares with the world, and it shares primarily with your family, how you yourself want your assets to pass. So, and if it's done in a very clear and concise way, then no one can dispute what's being said or try to create something that's not there. So the thing is, the whole idea is to provide clarity for a family and not confusion, because it's hard enough when a family passes, when a family member passes.
Let's say you had a situation, for example, where you might have had a family where, there were several siblings, and say one of them, let's say, was on drugs or something, and the surviving, not the surviving, but the person who's actually passing the assets on to their beneficiaries does not want that money wasted. They know that if I give this person this money, they're just going to blow it. You know what I mean? I work too hard for this. You know what I mean? I'm not going to allow that to happen. So they will, they just, let's say they don't even put that person in the will. I mean, specify that none of the assets are to go to this individual. The law would vary from state to state, but could they say in Virginia, a person say, well, as a child, I am rightfully owed one, let's say if they had three kids, one third, you know, of this, even though it was specified that this person was to get nothing. I mean, once, I guess, does the signed will override the state law is going to mesh with the will of the person that's actually passing on the assets because it's what they are desiring?
Well, that's a real good question to answer. I mean, you know, the bottom line is that, sure, in dealing with children, what you want to do is that, you know, you want to be clear. So probably what I would suggest to someone, if they're preparing a will and it's gotten to the point where the children now would be the next in line really to be beneficiaries, then you'd really want to identify all of your children in the will to specifically say that I acknowledge that these are all my children. And in fact, because that's the case, then this is the way I want things to happen. Now, there are possible grounds that a child could bring, but if a person's in their right mind and they have clarity, and usually when you prepare a will, there are certain requirements that have to be met when a person prepares a will. But aside from that, if a person, you know, does have clarity and they do it at a point in their life when they have their wits and they know exactly what they want to do, then it's very highly unlikely for somebody to be able to come forward and try to challenge the authenticity of the will in saying that this person might have been coerced or there could have been fraud or some level of duress that could have been imposed on this person for purging me out of a will. So, so you know, the thing is that's those are some of the calls that we make, you know, as attorneys to examine people. You know, I'm not saying that you go under a psychological examination when you meet with clients, but the bottom line is that, you know, people have to have their wits. They have to know what's going on, and they have to. Under Virginia law, it's not a very high standard. I mean, you just have to be lucid at that particular point in time, and not only the attorney, but also the witnesses primarily are able to observe whether or not it appears that this person understands the extent of the assets they own and has an idea or is competent enough to be able to determine who they want their assets to go to. So it's not a very high standard, but you know, an attorney with his salts will make sure that he or she are very comfortable with the people that come forward to feel that these individuals have the capacity to be able to do what they plan to do in their wills. So
you know, Brother Carter, it's a discussion, I think, that so many people just, for whatever reason, well, not for whatever reason, I understand the reason, because, you know, when you're talking about wills and estates and the trusts and stuff, I mean, it makes people think about the passing of, you know, one of their dearly beloved and what's going to happen when this person goes. And nobody wants to think about that. And I just had a friend recently within the last few months who just, his mother passed away from complications related to cancer, and he was sharing with me that it, I guess, got to a point where she didn't have a will, I don't believe, and it didn't appear. I mean, as much as they were praying for her and they were exercising faith that she would make it, she didn't have a will, but it became time to discuss that. And people felt like, you know, now's not the time. You know, come on, you don't want to burden mama with that right now. You don't want to talk about no will right now. Mama's dying. You know, you don't want to, you know, don't be, don't come in here with that. But, you know, the brother was sharing with me that it was a conversation that needed to happen because what was going to happen with, you know, whatever her assets were when she passed away. So if you could just even talk about the importance of having that discussion while, again, you're not sick, you know, while you are lucid, because at a time, God forbid that you grow old and, you know, you contact some disease and you're, you know, dying or withering away or something and people are around your bedside, nobody wants to have a conversation about a will with somebody while they're on their deathbed. So, you know, and not to mention, we assume that we're going to grow old. You know, we assume that tomorrow's promised, but, you know, people die in car accidents all the time. People have sudden heart attacks and die. I mean, you know, we just assume that, oh, I'll get to that. I don't want to do that today. I'll get to that, you know. But if you could just talk about the importance of having that done, because tomorrow is not promised. Yes, we hope to wake up in the morning, but there's no guarantee that we will. And in the event that we don't, then we could leave our families in a very precarious, confusing, sometimes hostile environment.
Yeah, I think you hit it right on the head, Juwanza. You know, the bottom line is that, you know, hopefully, you know, it is not an issue that, you know, most of us like to talk about. Like you said, the way you started the program and, you know, even where we are right now. I mean, usually most of us, when we're very young, you know, we're just getting started, you know, we're invincible. And in light of that being the case, you know, that's not even something that even comes up as a part of the discussion. And then the other thing is that most people say, well, hey, man, you know, I don't have money for that. You know,
right.
It's, you know, it's not something, it's not a priority. And it's understandable. And in most instances, when people are single, you know, that's usually what people, the mindset that they have. Well, you know, I'll just take care of that at another time in my life. And then usually what happens after that is when a person gets married and they have children, the problem there is that most of us are scrambling, trying to make it and trying to take care of our expenses and pay for a mortgage and acquire a few things here, maybe take the kids and do things with the children. You know, so priorities are different. And it, you know, I mean, that's just the reality of life. So, you know, the resources might be far and few during that time frame to be able to think about it. And most people, you know, have some idea that, you know, when you go to see a lawyer that, holy smokes, you know, man, that's just a lot of money. And and for some people, it is. But for most, you know, I think you'd be surprised. You know, depending on the attorney that you deal with, now I do suggest you go to an attorney that really understands the area and can provide you with, you know, a very capable service because unfortunately sometimes you do get tied into lawyers that may charge little or nothing for it, and that's usually going to be the type of product you get too. That could also cause a problem for you as well. So I think, you know, I think you just need to be prudent in your search for counsel to help you with that process. But I think for most people that are out there with reasonable estates, you know, the cost of wills and, you know, power of attorneys, those are other documents we may discuss, advanced medical directives. You know, these documents, you know, they can add up, but if it's done, you know, systematically and methodically based on a person's budget, it's something that can be done and it won't be as much of a burden as what most people might think. So I think that really the main thing for most people is to get over the misnomer of the cost of it, because bottom line is, as you stated, Juwanza, taking care of your business certainly while you're in your right mind and knowing what's going on and sharing that information with your family is critical so that there will be a smooth transition upon a person's passing in the future. So it's critical that people do this. But what's more important is everybody has those kinds of discussions with their family, even though they might not be the easiest conversations to have. But just to kind of talk about it in concept that, you know, if something should happen, then this is the way I would like to see things move forward so that there's no surprises and that everybody in their mind has an idea as to how mom and dad would want things to be handled or how brother or sister or cousin or aunt or whoever, so that, you know, so that there really won't be surprises. And so it's important. That those discussions be had, like you said, you know, as early on and when your family is mature enough to receive it. You know, clearly if you have, you know, minor children, I mean, that's just not a part of the equation. But that's still a discussion for amongst between spouses as well as maybe with parents because parents will probably want to have those discussions with children, adult children. And there's nothing wrong with adult children having those discussions with their parents as well, or adult brothers and sisters. So,
you know, I
so
know
it just
that
depends.
You know, I know that you've probably seen this or heard stories about, you know, situations where you might take a family that, let's say, for example, they might have five or six kids, okay, but they don't have six cars, you know. I have six cars to give each one a car or each one a house, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what would you suggest or can you advise a best course of action when it comes to you don't have enough assets to go around and the children may be viewing whatever you give to one that if they don't get the same and equal value, they assume that you love that one more than you love them. So if you don't have a house to give each one, okay, and if you say, well, okay, I'm going to leave the house to all of them, I'm going to leave this one house to everybody and put them all on, they all got a piece of this house, that's a fight right there waiting to happen because at some point somebody's going to want to sell the house or somebody's not going to want to sell the house, or, you know. So when you don't have enough assets, say, to go around, we're just talking about beneficiaries now, let's say if it's children, then how do you suggest, I mean, do you counsel in that regard as well?
Sure. Well, you know, if there's ambivalence regarding how assets will pass, primarily, let's say, like you said, I mean, let's say, for instance, a person has several tangible assets that are worth something, but let's say there are five children, and meaning, like you said, using the example of automobiles, let's say that a person, you know, has done well enough to have three nice automobiles during their lifetime. And that's all that they have, but they have five kids. And let's say the automobiles are about equal in value, but there's not an automobile that can go to each child. Well, in that particular circumstance, what you might suggest to the client is just going ahead and selling all three automobiles. And then whatever the net proceeds are from the sale of the automobiles, that's distributed among the children equally. So then that's something that equitably can be handled pretty efficiently, and it won't be an issue. Or let's say, for instance, there is a child that's interested, you know, really has their mind on, let's say they have an antique automobile there, a certain, you know, let's say a special, this person has a Lamborghini or something along those lines, all right? And one child has his mind or her mind on that car, then that child can buy that car from the estate. And then those monies that are used to purchase the car, then those monies that that child uses to buy the car, that is, you know, negotiated among everybody in the family, primarily through the executor of the estate who is responsible for handling the affairs of the estate. Then what happens is that money comes into the estate, and then that money can be distributed among all the children equally. Even though that one child, that one of those five children paid for that car and will be entitled to get the net proceeds from the sale of that automobile after the estate is wound up, you know, a portion of that money back, that is one way to possibly handle, you know, any kind of, you know, disagreement or a gripe that one family member might have to another. So, you know, there are tricks here and there that, you know, people can think about. You'd be surprised that there are a number of people that come in that have already kind of had in their mind what they want to do. But then, you know, there are some people that come to the office that just say, well, I don't know what to do.
Right.
So then you do have to create, you know, ideas for them to think about what they may want to consider in passing on, you know, to family members. So you're right, Jawan. I mean, there are certain things that clearly a will be able to help a person through and help to disarm family members that might feel slighted if they're not given something specifically from the person that's died. So clearly you're right. You know, those are some of the things that we share with clients. And, you know, sometimes clients hear what you're saying and sometimes they don't. So it just depends, you know.
So for those who are just joining the conversation, my special guest is Attorney Gerald Carter. We're talking about estate planning, wills, trusts, I mean, getting your house in order. I don't want to assume that everybody knows what some of these terms mean. And I know that in dealing with, you know, this type of issue, the word trust is going to come up, not trust as in honesty, but trust as a vehicle, not a car, but a investment vehicle to, I'll let you explain it. What is a trust as it relates to this
discussion? Okay. Well, I mean, primarily, Jawanza, there are two types of trust primarily. Okay. There is primarily a trust that we establish during our lifetime, which is called an inter vivos trust, and then a trust that could be prepared or established through a will, which is called a testamentary trust. Okay, when a person dies, they're usually designated as a person that's called either a decedent, or if you die with a will, you die testate. And remember, mm-hmm. the concept I discussed, if you die without a will, you call it intestate. So you die testate with a will. So a testamentary trust is basically a trust that is established through a will, okay? And then you have the other type of trust called a inter vivos trust or a living trust for the most part. That's just a very generic type of term because that's used interchangeably with other kinds of things. But the concept is when a person creates a trust during their lifetime, it's called an inter vivos trust. And clearly, just in concept, you know, a trust, whether established during the time you're living inter vivos or during the time of when you die through a will or through a testamentary trust, in essence, what happens is there are primarily three components to a trust. All right, there's what we call either the grantor or trustor, and what that means is, usually that is the person that establishes the trust, okay? That is usually the person that writes the trust. What that person does is they contribute an asset to be owned by the trust. So in this particular instance, if I have $100 and I'm the trustor and I want to establish the trust, then what happens is, and I'm doing this during my lifetime, then what happens is I make a gift. Remember the concept of gift, all right, mm-hmm. with the trust. You transfer the asset into the trust, okay? And what happens is by transferring the asset into the trust, primarily it's deemed to be like a gift. Now, of course, there could be exceptions to it depending on the type of trust that's established. But mm-hmm. the concept is that you are conveying an asset that you own, you're transferring that now to be owned by the trust. All right. The next person that's key in a trust is called the trustee. Now, trustee is important because the trustee is responsible for overseeing the maintenance, operation, and investment of the asset in the trust. All right.
Mm-hmm.
So, in essence, the trustee now holds the responsibility to be able to manage the trust for however long the trust is going to be in place. The third component of a trust is called a beneficiary or beneficiaries. And these are the people or the individuals or entities or whoever it is that benefit by the asset that has been put into the trust. And the beneficiaries, in essence, either receive any kind of residual value or interest or earnings from the trust. And then ultimately, if the trust is terminated or it ends at some point in time, then whatever that asset is or whatever it has grown into during the life of the trust, that asset then is distributed or passed on to the beneficiaries of the trust. So in concept with the trust, you have what we call the trustor, which is really the person or the grantor, and that's the person that establishes the trust and transfers the asset into or assets into the trust. Then you have the trustee, who is responsible for managing the trust and maintaining it for whatever term the trust has. And then you have the beneficiaries, who are the individuals or whatever entity or whoever it is that received the benefit by the asset that has been placed into the trust. Okay. Now, this can be done either when a person is living or when a person is deceased. The concept is still the same. When a person is living, like I said, you have the grantor, trustor, meaning, let's say, the person who's living, they set up the trust, put the asset in the trust, you have the trustee to operate it, and then you have the beneficiaries. What happens is when a person who dies, what happens is the same concept. You take an asset from a person's estate, meaning usually through the executor, the person who is responsible for handling the trust, handling the estate of a decedent, that person, that executor, or could be administrator, just depends, transfers the asset into the trust that is set up through the will. And then there are beneficiaries to that trust based on the terms of the will that, in essence, set up the trust after a person has died. So in concept, that is really the concept of a trust. Now, of course, we could take it many other different ways as to how you vary that. But in concept, that is what you find as basically the rudimentary components to establishing a trust, either during your lifetime through an inter vivos trust or through your will through a testamentary trust.
Can people use a trust to, say, shield assets? You know, for example, they set up a trust and they want to protect certain assets from, you know, from whatever. You know, can they say, okay, well, I'm putting this in under the trust, and now since it's in the trust, then, you know, it's shielded or it's protected against creditors or, you know, whatever. You know, people can't get it because it's under the trust.
Well, yeah. I mean, it depends on when a person does it. So it depends, and it depends on who is basically the target of perhaps a creditor or somebody adverse to a person. All right. Mm-hmm. If let's say, for instance, I'm the trustor, and I have, let's say, $100,000 of money, okay. For some reason, I feel that even though no one has filed a claim against me or filed a suit against me or anything along those lines, there could be the possibility that someone may try to come after me. All right. Then what happens is, and let's say before anybody might do anything along those lines that would create the possibility that somebody has a claim against me, and I transfer the asset into the trust, and I call the trust for the most part. And remember, I said, now there are variations in trust. Now, like I said, you have the inter vivos trust, but also as another component of an inter vivos trust, you have either what we call a revocable trust or an irrevocable trust. All right. And let's say that I set it up as a revocable trust. All right. Then what happens is, if it's a revocable trust, and I'm trying to conceal this asset from somebody else, then it is conceivable that someone could knock on your door, sue you, and try to get that trust invaded because of the fact that I have the ability at some point in time to say, hold on, all bets are off with this trust. I terminate the trust, and now the asset needs to come back to me. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
If it's revocable. However, though, if it's irrevocable, and I transfer that asset, and a certain number of years have passed, okay, and I remove that asset from my personal property or remove it from my estate, then in many instances, sometimes a creditor might not be able to go after it. But a lot depends on timing, and a lot depends on having the premonition that if someone might have a claim against you, when that person might move forward and file that claim against you. So it would depend, okay? The second scenario is the beneficiary, okay? Let's say you put an asset in a trust, but then you have a beneficiary that has creditors knocking on the door, all right? And so what you might say is, well, okay, I have children that perhaps aren't the best financially fiscal planners, and they're not that fiscally responsible. But I do create a trust for their benefit. Then what happens in that particular instance, even though this child has a beneficiary interest in the trust, if I establish the trust as what we call a spendthrift trust and really just have a spendthrift provision, then under Virginia law, what that means is that creditor of that child or that beneficiary could not come after that asset initially. And under Virginia law now, I believe the exemption is or the exclusion is up to $1 million. What happens is that creditor could not invade the trust, at least for that beneficiary's interest, to the extent of the value of that interest being up to $1 million. Now, if anything goes beyond $1 million that accrues, that is attributable to that child or that beneficiary, then, yeah, the trust, that particular creditor could come in and try to remove assets attributable to that child that are worth over $1 million. So it would depend, you know, but it is a tool that people do use to try to at least protect beneficiaries from the attack of creditors that they have, so that hopefully at some point in time they can right the ship and then be able to receive that asset, you know, if the trust is terminated at some point in time. Now, one other point to bring up is that now by having that spendthrift provision in the trust, and let's say, for instance, the child owes $500,000 to a creditor and then gets a distribution out of the, even though he owes this creditor $500,000, and then that creditor has, in essence, a judgment against that beneficiary, then what happens is, and that child gets $100,000, if that creditor can find that $100,000, they can get it. Okay. Mm-hmm. So what happens is that in that particular circumstance, the asset now has been removed out of the protection of the spendthrift, safe harbor. Mm-hmm. And so in that circumstance, yeah, all bets are off. That child either better spend the money wisely or try to work out a deal with that creditor to pay him something so they can keep something. So it just depends. But, yeah, I mean, there is planning that can be done. And then there are laws written that don't allow you to just go and do things and just remove them from the ability of creditors to get to your assets as well, you know, as well. So, you know, so somebody, you know, you have to navigate correctly through that process. Because you don't want to get also caught in a problem where somebody tries to assert that you've tried to hinder and defraud your creditors through assets that might be in a trust. So it just depends. My best advice, Jawanz, is for a person, if they're thinking about those kinds of issues, is to seek counsel, you know, and to get
everybody
the right
special
kind
guest
of counsel.
Gerald Carter, I know you're enjoying this conversation. I see the listeners on the board. If you have a question, all you have to do is just press 1, and I'll bring you on, and you can ask your question or make your comment. Let's talk about, if we could, the power of attorney the trustee. For example, let me have a trustee question first. Let's say, for example, the person is the trustee and you have beneficiaries. There may be somebody that deals with this or has dealt with this or at some point in the future may have to deal with it. Let's say the beneficiaries how often should they get an accounting of the assets that are coming into the estate? Let's say the estate is owed money, okay, from some other source, and the beneficiaries want to know what's going on, you know. How often should the trustee report to, or is it just by request? Whenever the beneficiary says, hey, what's going on? Can I get an accounting of everything that's come into the estate and what's been done with that money?
Okay. All right, let me just, you know, I guess I didn't, I know we kind of jumped around a little bit. Let me just kind of backtrack with you a little bit, Juwanza. We're
okay.
Talking about when a person is deceased or when a person is living. Okay. That's my first question.
They've passed on, and now they have an estate in place with beneficiaries receiving or supposed to receive certain assets from the estate, and let's say there's money owed to the estate that the estate is getting from wherever, you know, I don't know. But how often should a beneficiary get an accounting of the financial status of the estate? Is it
okay.
upon request, anytime they ask for it, just, hey, give me an accounting of what's been coming in for the last, you know, 3 months, how's the money been distributed, and is there any clause that would suggest that the trustee doesn't have to give accounting to the beneficiaries?
Okay. All right. Well, first of all, see, I didn't make this clear earlier. With an estate, okay, let's say you have a will, okay, the person that you appoint in a will to take care of the affairs of the estate is called an executor.
Okay.
All right. And the executor is someone who you believe when you prepare your will is someone you have, you know, a great deal of confidence in that they will be able to properly handle and manage the assets of the estate so that the assets are properly marshaled, you know, liquidated if need be, debts are paid, and then whatever is left is distributed to the beneficiaries or distributed in a trust if that is the desire of the decedent, okay? But the executor is someone who you appoint in your will. And so what happens is that an executor, you know, I usually suggest to people that they have at least one executor, sometimes co-executors, depending on who they're going to have, and then also to have alternate executors, just in case the executors, the initial or the primary executor or executors they put in place have either predeceased them or no longer able to handle the affairs of the decedent. So usually that is the first step that you have in a will for the person that's going to handle the affairs of an estate.
Okay.
Now, what also happens is, let's say that all your executors either die before you die, meaning the person that prepared the will, or all the executors decline the appointment in being your executor. Then what happens in that instance, then the court then appoints what we call an administrator to step in and handle the affairs of the estate. So it would just depend on the circumstances. But in most instances, you know, if you have a primary executor and then a secondary and maybe even a tertiary executor, one of those individuals or maybe a combination of those individuals will accept the appointment. Okay. Now, from there, what happens is the executor, though, is responsible for, you know, as I've mentioned, you know, marshaling the assets, getting them together, reading the will, making sure that assets are properly distributed, and primarily making sure also that the debts of the decedent have been paid before anything substantial or anything that the estate can't handle are taken care of before assets are distributed. So what happens is you'd hope you'd have somebody responsible that in essence doesn't distribute anything until all the debts are paid. And then once the debts are paid, then the executor would then move forward and start distributing assets to the beneficiaries of the estate. Now, usually what happens is that beneficiaries are notified as to whether or not a person's will has been what we call probated, and that is, you know, perhaps a term of art that maybe people might have heard about and might not have heard about. And in essence, probate means that a person actually goes to court, meets with the deputy clerk, at least in the state of Virginia, along with the executor and maybe some people to the family, depending on the circumstances, to be able to go to court and probate the will. And probating the will, for the most part, is basically the recordation of the will with the court. All right? And what that does is it puts people on notice that this person is deceased, and then this is this person's will, and this is the way this person wants their assets to be distributed upon their passing. And there are costs associated in probating a will. But, you know, for the most part in the state of Virginia, it is, I won't say it's a modest cost, but it's a reasonable cost compared to other jurisdictions in the United States. So it would just depend. But getting back to your question about what sort of responsibility an executor has to the beneficiaries, an executor has a very, very important responsibility, or what we call a fiduciary responsibility, to the beneficiaries of an estate. And what that means is it's a responsibility of trust and confidence. So that means that an executor is not supposed to misappropriate monies, not to do anything, you know, that would not be appropriate in the handling of somebody's estate and ultimately passing on the assets to beneficiaries. Now, there are safeguards, you know, in Virginia. What usually is required is when a person probates a will and moves forward in handling an estate as an executor is required to perform an inventory of all the assets of a person's estate, the decedent's estate. So the inventory, in essence, should list, for the most part, the assets of the estate and a value tied to them, so that is something that is on record with the court, and it's something that we file with a person that we call a designated person by the court called a commissioner of accounts. And a commissioner of accounts, primarily in the state of Virginia, are practicing lawyers that are designated by the court system to oversee that process of estate management. So the inventory is usually filed with the commissioner of accounts, and then the commissioner then records it or files it with the court to document the estate, so that if beneficiaries or any other third party have questions about the estate, they can go to court and request a copy from the court of the inventory that's been filed. Mm-hmm. Then secondly is that an executor, for the most part, is required to file annual accountings. And the accountings show either the receipt of more assets into the estate from the time of the inventory, and then also the disbursement of assets, either through paying expenses and debts of the estate or making distributions to beneficiaries of the estate during a specific period of time. And usually the period of time is on an annual or 12-month basis. And depending on how long the estate is open, the executor is required to file annual accountings with the Commissioner of Accounts until the estate is finally closed and there is a final accounting that is prepared. So, you know, the safeguard to the beneficiaries is that they could either go to the Commissioner of Accounts and request a copy. Well, they can initially go to the executor and ask for a copy of the accounting. If the executor somehow refuses to comply, then they can go to the Commissioner of Accounts and then ultimately the court to get copies of these documents just to see the assets are of the estate and how the assets have been handled during the lifespan of the estate.
And if it's deemed that, you know, funds were misappropriated or, you know, not disclosed or, you know, anything like that, that's a federal offense, correct? Would that be a felony?
It probably would be. I mean, well, I won't say it's federal, but it's yes. I mean, bottom line is, yeah, that's a problem. All right. If an executor misappropriates money and does criminal acts, then not only is the executor culpable, economically or financially for any shortfall or damage caused to the estate, but also, like you said, criminal charges can be brought up against an executor for misappropriating or fraudulently handling the affairs of an estate. Yeah. So you, if you're appointed in that position, you have to take it very seriously and recognize the fact that that you could be brought up on charges if you do something incorrectly. Some people, actually do it, and it could be innocent, but they still could be brought up criminally for, doing illegal acts in their commission of a thought of their duties as the executor of an estate. Absolutely.
Well, I know. Are you good on time? I know it's 8. It's been an hour. You good? You got a few more minutes?
I do. I have a few more minutes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Everybody, again, if you have questions, all you have to do is just press 1, and I can bring you on board. If we could talk about the executor and the power of attorney for a second. Now, the executor of the estate, would it be a conflict of interest for the executor of an estate, the person that, is in charge of handling, making sure all the bills are paid, the debts are paid, and before all of them, before any of the money is distributed, would it be a conflict of interest for that person to also be a beneficiary?
Not necessarily. I mean, when you assume the role of executor, I mean, you're assuming the role as, a fiduciary of everybody. There is, the concept of self-dealing or something along those lines, but I do think that you can clearly demark your responsibility as an executor from being a beneficiary of an estate. So, and there are safeguards that are in place that you have to follow as an executor, even though you could benefit as a beneficiary of the estate. And usually, the other thing is usually, probably more of a problem of misdealing occurs if a person is either, maybe a witness to the will or something along those lines, and then also a beneficiary of the estate, because perhaps they could have more say, when a decedent is preparing their will, or more sway with the decedent as to a way for them to get more assets before that person, that's documented in the will. And then ultimately when the will is, is probated, when the decedent dies, then that person would be able to receive more because the damage was done when the decedent was alive as opposed to when the decedent is dead. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But bottom line is, Juwan, that sure, there could be areas of misdealing, and that's why, you would hope that a decedent's going to pick special people to serve in that capacity, people of integrity and of character that are going to do the right thing, that are going to get help from professionals to be able to make sure that things are done correctly. Now, one thing I do want to emphasize with you, and I do know we're very short on time, you mentioned power of attorney. And one thing I do want to share with our listeners is that that a power of attorney is a very, very important document, but it is a document separate and aside from a will. A will is a document that comes into effect when a person dies. Okay. A power of attorney is a document that comes into effect while a person is alive. All right. So there is a distinction. The power of attorney terminates once a person dies. And in essence, the will picks up from when a person, when the power of attorney terminates, conceivably. Okay. So what happens is the power of attorney, the importance of the power of attorney is designating somebody to help make financial decisions for you if you're not able to do that while you're living. And in many instances, that is a critical document because what happens is that if you don't have a document like that and if somebody becomes incapacitated, then what happens in that particular circumstance is that the person is not able to handle their affairs. And then when that happens, you have to go through a whole court process in order to get somebody appointed as to what we call a conservator to take care of your financial affairs while you're living. And it can turn into a very expensive process. So I just want to share that. I don't know if we have enough time to really talk about that this evening.
We're good. I mean, we're good as long as you're good. I mean, we can go another 50 minutes if you want to. I mean, we're good. Fun time.
Okay, well, I'm not going to be able to do that this time, but maybe another time. But
have to have you back.
But I mean, there is a difference, and it's important. And the power of attorney, it's a critical document for people because it deals with a person's welfare during their lifetime. Then again, there too, like you said, the person that you appoint to take charge of your financial affairs under a power of attorney is called an attorney in fact. And sometimes people might call him an agent. They might call them different kinds of things, but the concept, the term of art is called attorney in fact. And that person, again, you're trying to find a person that is truthful, that's going to do the right thing, that's going to look out for your best interest, and they're going to handle your affairs the way hopefully you would do if you were able to do that yourself. So it just depends. But that document is very important because you're living. Some people I've even kind of said a few times to some clients, that document can be more important than your will. Because it affects you during your lifetime. When you die, clearly, you don't want to cause confusion, and that's why will is critical, don't get me wrong. But to deal with a person who is not able to handle their affairs and they're living, and then conceivably, it also is very important that you have somebody in place that's not going to be a person that would steal from you as well. So it's, there's just a number of things that I think why the power of attorney in some instances could be more important and more to a person than the will. But both documents are equally as important, based on their purpose.
You would think that a power of attorney would be or could be or should be maybe somebody neutral, because if a person stands to benefit, let's say their power of attorney and a beneficiary, or let's say, for example, you might have a situation where one person doesn't want to, the person who is establishing the will, or in need of the power of attorney might have, let's say they got two kids and they don't want to offend one by picking one, and so they say, well, okay, I'll make you both co-power of attorneys. Seems like when you get into this co-stuff, it seems like it's inevitable at some point that there's going to be disagreements between the two people that are charged with caring for the, daddy or mama, because one might think, for example, let's just say one says, well, mama's getting kind of old or daddy's getting kind of old, I think we need to put him in a nursing home. And the other one's like, have you lost your mind? I would never put daddy in a nursing home or whatever, but they're both co-power of attorneys, So it just seems like a situation like that, those co-stuff seems like it's bound to at some point set two people at odds with one another. But if you had a neutral person that, could take the emotion out of, making a decision, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, we have to differentiate what you just said. First of all, the power of attorney, we usually call it a durable power of attorney, deals primarily with finances. Okay, it doesn't deal with healthcare decisions. Okay, so if your attorney, in fact, under a durable power of attorney, you won't even be at the point where you deal with healthcare decisions of the individual. Okay.
Okay.
Then there's another document we call, because we, believe me, lawyers, we have documents for everything, all right? So we got another document, and we call that the Advanced Medical Directive, okay? And the Advanced Medical Directive, for the most part, from a colloquial way of describing the document is the healthcare power of attorney. Right? And what happens is under that document, you appoint an agent or agents to make medical decisions for you when you can. Okay. Now, the difference between the two is that, you know, one deals primarily with medical and healthcare decisions. The other document deals with financial. All right. And also, one thing to bring to light is that what causes the documents to come into effect. All right. Usually with a medical power of attorney or healthcare or the advanced medical direct is incapacitated, or a person is at a point where they can't make a medical decision for themselves. All right. So usually you would never really have a family member making any kind of medical decision for you unless you can't do it for yourself. That's the bottom line. On the durable power of attorney, sometimes you can structure that the same way where they wouldn't come into effect. You could prepare it, but it wouldn't spring into effect unless a person is disabled, you know, or not disabled. The person is, you know, incapacitated, just like what would be necessary usually if the healthcare power of attorney comes into effect. The real question is, though, on the financial side, you know, that might not necessarily be the most practical thing to do because even though a person, you know, medically might not be able to do much, they still can make decisions regarding their medical care. However, though, on the financial side, if a person is disabled, okay, they still, you know, it might be difficult for them to drive to this bank to deal with this creditor, to deal with a number of other things, even though they're able to make decisions. So what might come into effect for both documents would depend on what the individual will want to have in place for themselves when they assign people to make these decisions. Usually what I do is that for a durable financial power of attorney, I don't set it up where it's springing. I usually set it up where you designate a person or persons to make financial decisions for you. So it's critical that you pick very, very, very people you feel are trustworthy people, people of character, and people that are going to do the right thing and aren't going to try to do things in a self-dealing way. So it's important that you would do that, because what happens is, what I propose for clients is that you just pick someone who you feel you have a great deal of confidence in, and then you have the power of attorney in place. And if there is a need for somebody to use it, it is already in place.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So it would not be something that's springing or anything along those lines. So, for instance, let's say, you know, by the grace of God, now I'm competent and I can take care of my affairs. But I might say, all right, well, I do want my wife and my adult to have be my attorney in facts. I would want them to be able to act for me if for some reason something should happen to me, or I am to the point where it's very difficult for me to take care of something financially. So what I mean by that is this. Let's say, for instance, I get sick. I get a terrible case of the flu, and I'm laid up for weeks. Or let's say I break my leg or do something along those lines, which cause a great deal of difficulty for me in getting around. But if I need my daughter to go to this bank and I need her to take care of this thing over here and this matter over here, then she will have the power of attorney to be able to do it. Now, of course, once I regain my, you know, my faculties again, then I'm going to tell her that I can take care of my own business. Okay.
Right.
But what happens is you do have it in place so that, you know, it is available for people that you trust and you know are going to do the right thing to take care of your affairs when you can't do it. Now, it's also in place, of course, as well, if you become incapacitated or other things, and then the document is in place, and then they automatically know what they need to do. All right. On the advanced medical directive side of the healthcare power of attorney, what happens is that In that circumstance, you know, I'm always going to be able to make a decision for myself unless I become incapacitated or, you know, clearly a person that doesn't know what's going on. So, you know, if I broke my leg or if I was laid up with the flu, I still can make medical decisions that impact me. So the advanced medical directive clearly would not come into effect until, you know, some catastrophic event occurred where I would be incapacitated and not be able to take care of those affairs for myself. So, you know, but bottom line is, like you said, Juwan, you got to pick someone, you got to hand pick them. And then, you know, you got to make sure you pick the right person or right individual or individuals to be able to do what's necessary. And you know your family. You know friends. You know different people. You know, there are sometimes different people that can handle things and some people that can't, okay? And then sometimes, you know, like you said, if you have two kids and let's say, for instance, one is just, you know, so sharp as a tack. I mean, they're rocket scientists. And the other one, you know, well, needs a little work, okay? But you don't want to, you know, lower the self-esteem of the one that's perhaps maybe not where he or she needs to be, but with the help of the one that's sharp as a tack, then they'll be able to make the right decision. And maybe it might help the one that's not sharp as a tack to get sharper. So, you know, I mean, those are the kinds of decisions we make, everybody would make in life that hopefully will help your family grow and get better all around in handling not only your affairs, but their affairs and then their family's affairs, you know, and right down the line. So it just, you know, it just depends. And then on the medical side, you know, if they're going to be critical decisions, medical decisions that need to be made, you might not want to put, you know, a young adult, you know, a young child, young adult child in a position to make those decisions because they might not be able to handle it. All right. And then again, you might have some middle-aged people too and older people that can't handle it too. So it just, it depends. It really depends. But you got to, you know, you pick them, okay? Usually if you're married, you know, clearly you're gonna go with your spouse in many instances, only unless you know that for some reason your spouse one way or the other maybe might not be able to handle it. But then again, you know, it could be, you know, it's a self-esteem thing. Well, if I bring this person in as well, then I think my spouse, with the help of this person, can make the right decision. So, you know, you have to balance that. And those are some of the kinds of things we discuss. And those are the things we share with clients so that they make the right kind of decisions so that there's harmony in their family and everybody's moving along correctly.
You know, here's another thought, and I know when I wind it up because I know we've gone over a consideration for people is to just, you know, give it to them now. You know what I'm saying? I mean, because I always found it curious that people would wait until they died before they actually gave something or left something for somebody. I know that if I was in a position to give something to somebody, I want to see them enjoy it. You know, I want to see them enjoying what I've labored for or whatever. I want to actually see with my eyes them enjoying and benefiting from or whatever it is that I'm left for them to be a blessing. I want to see them be blessed. I want to see the kids playing in the park or riding in the car or enjoying whatever it is that I decided to leave for them. That way I know that I can definitely ensure who gets what because I'm alive. I gave it to them, you know, and I don't have to worry about nobody fighting over, you know, any estate or anything, you know. So that's an option too, you know, for some people. Hey, you can give it to them while you don't have to wait until they die to give them whatever it is that you want to leave for them. You know, that's an option.
That's true. That's true. That's true, brother. We encourage that as well. That's why I say, you know, an estate planner not only deals with planning when you die, but also when you're alive, okay? Because there are also other kinds of benefits, tax benefits and other kinds of things that we would say for a very in-depth conversation another time. But there are other considerations. But like you said, I mean, you bring, you know, in essence, I mean, that's those are really the kind of key issues that people should really try to deal with. And, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, I guess what some people feel is, you know, they're not mature enough to handle it. So, you know, that's why you sometimes create the trust, okay? So mm-hmm. it just depends on, you know, where your kids are, where your family is, you know, what you want to do. Also, we hadn't even gotten into charitable contributions and things along those lines that, you know, that are very important as well. Mm-hmm. So it depends on, you know, some people, you know, there's a certain type of legacy that some people would like to leave, not only to their children, but to, you know, to society as well. And so, you know, those are the kinds of things we discuss as well, depending on what, you know, a person's objectives are. So
right.
I agree with you, Jawanza. You know, I agree. You know, making gifts during a person's lifetime are very important as well. Now, there are some limitations to it that some people would need to be cognizant of, but not to the point where you still can't do that in most instances. So, you know, I think, like you said, that's very important. There's no question about it. So it's just a matter of planning during your lifetime and then after you pass, so post-mortem. So it just depends.
This has been a very, very powerful, powerful interview. You have shared a lot of very, very important information that I know that our listeners today have really, really benefited from. And I want to encourage everybody that, again, you know about the archives. You can go back and listen to this over and over again. You can actually share this information with somebody, a friend of yours, somebody who you feel needs this information and could definitely benefit from it. This is a conversation that we had today. This is a conversation that needs to be had more often. It needs to be had around the dinner table. You need to gather the people that are important in your life together to sit down and talk about these discussions now. You don't want to wait until, you know, because tomorrow's not promised. You don't want to, and you definitely don't want to wait until somebody's in the hospital and passing away and then trying to scramble and get a will together, you know, before the person passes away. That's definitely not the way to do it. So while you have the opportunity and you have the information, have that discussion, because it's not a sign that, you know, it's not something stating, oh, you're going to die. We're all going to die. That's the reality of it. We're all going to die one day. We just don't know when. And because we don't know when, we need to have something in place, because tomorrow's definitely not promised. You might live to see it, but what if you don't? Okay. Doctor, I want to please give your information, because I know there's somebody out there that wants to get in contact with you. They heard this show, and they're like, you know what, I need to call that brother because he knows what he's talking about, and I heard the information that was, you know, they were speaking to me today. I need to get that in place. How can they reach you? And, you know, you can share, you know, if there's certain times that they can reach you. Can they call you at the office? I mean, email address, whatever you need to share. How can they get in contact with you?
Sure, Jawanza, just thank you for the opportunity for letting me be on your show today. I greatly appreciate it, and I do hope that, you know, we were able to at least answer a few questions that people have, man. And so, you know, I'd really encourage, like you said, people to just, you know, look into things, ask these kinds of questions, and, you know, don't wait. Don't wait, you know, deal with the issues. And, you know, the sooner you deal with it, the better and the more peace of mind you're going to have. And in many instances, you know, it's not quite as expensive as what people think. But, you know, to some it could be. But to some others, they may see the merit in pursuing it. So thank
you
again for letting me be on your show.
And, it might be more expensive not to do it, bro. You know.
But I, you know, but thank you so much. Like Jawanza said, my name is Gerald Carter. I'm with the law firm of Harrell & Chambliss, LLP. We're located in downtown Richmond. My phone number, my direct dial is area code 804-915-3224. My paralegal's name, her name is Tiara Ross, and her number is area code 804-915-3238. My email address, Gerald Carter's, is gcarter@hclawfirm.com. And Tierra's email address is tross@hclawfirm.com. Also, I welcome you to go to our website. I think it's www.hclawfirm.com. And the name of our law firm, again, is Harrow & Chambliss, LLP. And thanks again for this opportunity, Juwanza, to be on your show. Appreciate it.
I appreciate you taking the time out of it. I know you're a busy brother, and I appreciate you taking the time out to share this information. Now, question, we have listeners from all over the world. I mean, you know, this is Blog Talk Radio. It's Internet. So people, I know people are listening up in the D.C. area, and I know they're listening down here in the Richmond area. If somebody's not in this jurisdiction, in the Richmond area, can they still benefit by calling you? Can you refer them to somebody maybe, let's say, up in D.C., or, you know, if they just have a question, I mean, can they call you? Or, you know, how would you go about that?
Well, I mean, it would depend. I do know someone in D.C. That I would refer them to. Actually, I know a couple people there, three attorneys there. You know, primarily in North Carolina. I don't know of too many planners there, but you know, I do know some people in other places. You know, I'm primarily focused on Virginia, so. If anybody really has a Virginia question, I certainly can be responsive. And, you know, if someone has a general question in concept, I could be responsive, but I can't be responsible for the fact that the information might not be fully correct because there could be some nuances, like you said, in other states that I'm not aware of. So it would just depend.
Okay. Well, Brother Gerald, I want to thank you again. This has been a very powerful interview. I encourage everybody to go back and listen to the archives. You can share this information with other people that you know may need it. Again, we all need it. This is one of those shows that everybody needs to hear because regardless of where you are, you know, wherever you live, this is something that's, you know, common to all of us. We're born and we're going to die, you know, and so we want to make sure that we have in place the things that need to be in place, that we can make sure that our house is in order so that, you know, once we live a fruitful life, we can pass on and, you know, not have to worry about burdening the people that we want to be blessings to with, you know, situations that are just confusing and overwhelming. In addition to them having to deal with our loss, then they have to deal with the other emotions that come along with now having to scramble to get our stuff together when we can do it while we're here. Brother Gerald, I want to thank you again, my brother. I'll be in touch. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Powerful, powerful interview, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you, brother. All right, now.
All right.
Happy New Year to you. All right.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Talk to you soon. Oh, we're going to have to do can we do a part two?
Sure. Sure.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And I don't know if we covered everything that you needed to cover, but you talked about some other documents that we didn't get into. So if we can talk about that, and then we can, you know, make sure that we give everybody all of the information that they need. And then, you know, I'll have you back as soon as I can.
Okay, brother. No problem. My pleasure.
Talk to you soon.
All right. Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Take care. That, everybody, is Gerald W.S. Carter, attorney. He's a partner with Harrow and Chambliss in Virginia, and we want to thank him so much for being our special guest today. Again, this information is valuable. Don't wait, okay? As we all know people, we woke up one day and somebody said, did you hear about so-and-so? What? They got hit by a car. What? No, so-and-so, what happened? They got hit by a stray bullet. What? So-and-so, what? What happened? They died of cancer. What? You know, is reality. Get your house in order. And get it in order now. Okay? Because, again, as we stated throughout all of this interview, tomorrow is not promised. If you woke up today and you went to bed today, thank God. Okay? But there are far too many horror stories about people who have passed on and as a result of not having their business straight, not having their house in order, it became a nightmare for their children, the people that they wanted to be a blessing to. Not only did they have to deal with the loss and deal with that, they also had to deal with and try to clean up, in many cases, situations that the person just did not do while they were here. Well, if you love the people that you say you love, then prepare. Get your house in order. Get your business straight so that when that day does come and we make that transition, that it can be smooth and that we can leave the people that we love the blessings that we want to leave them with. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I really appreciate the fact that you took time out to listen to this show today. Please share the information with others. And until the next time, you've been listening to Health, Wealth, and Divine. My name is Juwanza. Peace and blessings.